Welcome, everyone, to the Creation Liberty Podcast. This is show number 57 for February 19th, 2013. My name is Chris Johnson. I'm the founder of Creation Liberty Evangelism, where our purpose is to win the lost to Christ and to teach the truth of God's Word and science. We believe God's Word is the authority over mankind. We believe in the young earth creation account the Bible teaches in the book of Genesis, and we believe that evolution, as it is taught in the public schools of America today, is the dumbest and most dangerous religion in the history of mankind. And if you want to learn more, you can check us out at www.creationliberty.com. Today we're going to discuss the issue of radiometric dating and how it is all based on religion, not actual science. And I want to make sure people understand, especially Christians understand, that you want to stand on the foundation of God's Word, not stand on the foundation of, you know, okay, this guy has a PhD, so I better listen to him because he's my authority. No, the Bible has to be your final authority. And carbon dating is based primarily in religion, and that's what we're going to discuss right now. So first I want to tell you where carbon dating came from. In 1950, a guy named Willard F. Libby invented it, and then he won a Nobel Prize for it in 1960. Now, generally in the public schools of America and on mainstream TV, things like that, you'll find that the implication is given that because they have carbon dating, or they try to use carbon dating, therefore the Earth is older than the 6,000-year account the Bible teaches, and therefore the Bible is wrong, and therefore evolution is true. That is the implication that's given. I don't typically hear an evolutionist say that out loud, although I have looked at other Christian ministries and they have testimonies on their websites where they say, yes, we receive emails from evolutionists saying carbon dating proves evolution. I have never heard an evolutionist say that because most of them know carbon dating does not prove evolution. That's really not an argument I've really had to have with anyone. Maybe I will in the future. Maybe after I make this podcast, somebody will want to do it. Well, if they want to talk to me, they can. But typically, this is implied by mainstream TV, textbooks, things like that, that because we have carbon dating, therefore the Bible is wrong and evolution is true. And so we're going to unravel that and show you exactly why this carbon dating stuff is totally religiously based in the evolution philosophy. So our Earth's atmosphere is made up of 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, 0.06% carbon dioxide, and the remainder is a bunch of mixed random gases. And there are some very small traces, very, very tiny, tiny traces of what's called carbon-14 or C14, which is what's called a radioactive isotope. Now, I want to show you a diagram, and I'm going to explain to you what all this means. An isotope, and if you're struggling as a Christian, you're listening to this and you're like, well, I don't know that I can actually explain this. He's already starting to use a bunch of words I don't understand. Okay, guys, it doesn't matter what we study or what we're trying to understand. Even when we're understanding the law and understanding the gospel of Jesus Christ, it takes some study to understand it, and it takes time to study these things out. So if you feel that you know, God's landed on your heart, that you need to get an answer to this kind of stuff, well, this is how you're going to do it. And it does take some work, guys. You can't just, poof, the answer appears to you. I didn't understand all this stuff when I first started studying it either. You have to get to a point where you work and study and learn the material. So an isotope, by definition, is any of two or more forms of a chemical element having the same number of protons in the nucleus, or the same atomic number, but having a different number of neutrons in the nucleus. So typically, if you remember from any of your high school science classes, that when you study the atom like this, you're going to find that the protons and the neutrons are equal number, and that's what equals the atomic number. Okay, but what happens is that neutrons get added into an atom, and when that happens, it becomes radioactive, or a radioactive isotope, and it becomes, and what will happen normally when, like, carbon has an atomic weight of 12, neutrons get added, and nitrogen normally has an atomic weight of 14. But what happens is that when neutrons are added, the carbon becomes carbon-14, and which is, like I said, a radioactive isotope. So that's where, now C14 is produced from radioactive energy of the sun's rays striking nitrogen in our atmosphere, and you get carbon-14. And slowly, what's happening over time is the radioactive carbon-14 is breaking apart and it decays back down into normal nitrogen again. Now the time it takes for radioactive material to break down to its normal state is called half-life. That's a term you may have heard before. I think there's actually a computer game called Half-Life, which is based on half-life radioactivity. Now, carbon 14, for example, has a half-life of about 5,700 years on average. And that means that half of the radioactivity in C14 today, in 5,700 years' time, will decay to half that amount. So, you know, for example, take a look at this. And what I'm going to explain is that if you have, say you have a sample of carbon-14 that's 100%, it's a 100% sample of carbon-14. In 5,000 years, half of that will decay. So now you will have 50% left. In 5,000 years, half of that will decay, and you'll have 25% left. In another 5,000 years, half of that will decay, and you will have 12.5% left, and so on and so on. In theory, it never goes to zero, but after you have so many half-lives, the measurement is too small to be measured. So C14 dating would be only good, assuming that it worked at all, because we're going to discuss that in a moment. The dating would only be good for up to 40 to 50,000 years. So saying this proves evolution, I don't hear evolutionists making that statement, because they know it's only good for a certain amount of time. Now, plants breathe in carbon dioxide, so they will take in small traces of C14. And animals eat plants and make it part of their body, so they also take in small traces of C14. This is how it's supposed to work, in theory. So since you eat plants, or you eat animals that eat plants, you will have very tiny traces of C14 in your body as well. And these small traces can be detected with a Geiger counter, which is normally used to detect radioactive material. So, for example, let me see if I can get this to play here. I'll see if you can hear the noise. I'll turn this up just a little bit and see if you can get this to get to hear this. That's assuming if this loads. Sorry, guys. Hear that? This is a person that's actually, if you hear all that clicking in there, that's somebody that's using a Geiger counter. And a Geiger counter is typically, it measures radioactive material. And he was measuring an old perfume bottle. They used to use uranium glass, and it had small traces of radiation in it, which are technically dangerous. That's why they don't use that stuff anymore. So the theory goes that if you test for an object of C14, and it only has about half of the amount of C14 known to be in the atmosphere, which is 0.0000325%, somewhere around there, that they claim is supposed to be in there. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, too. Then that object has been dead for about 5,730 years. If you'd only find 1/4 of the C14 in an object, it would have been dead for 2 half-lives, which would be approximately 11,400 years, and so on and so on. So that's how they're typically dating these things. Now, I want you guys to imagine that you were going to find a consistent number of all the grasshoppers in the world. How would you begin? Good question. Because if you really think about that, you would literally have to be in all places in the world, at all places, at all times, at the same time, in order to confirm the presence or the non-existence of grasshoppers in all locations. Now, if you cannot be omnipresent, which is what would be required for such a feat, then all you can do is put a guess number on it. Like, well, we're estimating how many grasshoppers are in here based on this tiny little place we looked at, and so we're just going to make an average. That's basically what happens. So you can't even conceive, none of us could conceive how such a task could be accomplished to locate all the, you know, to get a number of all the grasshoppers in the world because we have such limited ability. And that's for something we can see like a grasshopper. It's impossible to do that with what's invisible to the naked eye. We can't even conceive how it would be possible to be able to get a proper number for the active radioactive carbon in the atmosphere right now. And no consistent amount of C14 has ever been calculated in the atmosphere, and it's not impossible for mankind to do such a thing without having a device at minimum that spanned the entire circumference of the atmosphere. All scientists can do and all they've done is test carbon levels in a few areas of our atmosphere, and they assume that everything everywhere else is exactly the same. That is not, first of all, I don't think that's a reasonable assumption at all. Now, it creates a serious problem because all measuring tools on the planet require a constant with which to measure anything. So I want you guys to imagine a moment, a ruler, okay? Now, in the United States, we have what's called the National Institute of Standards. And that any company that wants to develop a measuring tool can contact the National Institutes of Standards and Technology and find out what, you know, show, you know, give us the inch. They have, I've heard they have a, like a platinum, you know, inch ruler behind closed doors. It's locked, you know, it's sealed. So that way, you know, everybody in America uses the same standard inch. You see, because for example, let's say you and I were building framework for a house, but our tape measures were using two different standards for an inch. We wouldn't be able to complete the project because nothing would fit together properly. We have to be using the same standard of measurement, okay? There has to be a constant standard of measurement. Now, radioactive carbon, as mentioned earlier, you know, forms in the atmosphere from radiation striking nitrogen. And that radiation is randomly introduced into the atmosphere, so how could anyone keep track of that fluctuation? That's not possible. And also, I've had some evolutionists personally tell me through email correspondence that it is impossible to know for sure. They said, of course you can't get an absolute accurate measurement of that because it's impossible to know, because they said the Earth's magnetic field is fluctuating, and that also affects how much radiation comes through the atmosphere to create C14. And I told him, I said, did you realize you just proved my point? That you don't have an accurate measure for that, and there is no, according to what you're telling me here, there is no accurate way to get an absolute level of C14 in the atmosphere by which we can make all these comparisons. So everything they calculate is based on an assumption of a rate that was taken at one particular point in time, in one particular place, and nobody knows if the rest of the world is like that. It's a complete religious assumption. And that's the first thing we have to understand, is that there are no consistent measurements, no standards of measurements for C14. Now, we just logically demonstrated, just through a few simple short sentences, that to get a consistent rate and comparison for C14 in the atmosphere, it is just impossible. You can't do that. And now to build on that, the evolutionists must also assume that plants, animals, and people all match this non-existent standard. So, in addition, if we were to even possibly test for a level, like a constant level of C14 in the air, you know, let's say it were possible that we could do that and we got a consistent amount, it would not be possible to test and prove that all life had that exact same amount when it took in the C14 in the beginning. You would literally have to go back in time. You would have to have a time machine. Now, this is why some really wild numbers have appeared, like, for example, in Antarctic Journal, Volume 6, 1971, a freshly killed seal was carbon dated to be 1,300 years old. And that's why you get from Science Magazine, Volume 224, 1984, shells from living snails were carbon dated at 27,000 years old. That's why you get all these different wild numbers, because they don't know exactly how much this was taking in or why. Now, the evolutionists will argue that these wild dates come from a phenomenon called old carbon in the water on the ocean floor. But all that does is demonstrate that we cannot know for certain if the samples we get from the carbon dating are contaminated from other sources we are not aware of at this time. You don't know what you pulled from this source or that source was not contaminated over the past 10, 20,000 years or however long it took that you claim that was in the ground. You have no idea. So, again, it's all based on assuming the C14 in the object being dated is the same as the C14 in the atmosphere when the creature died. And we have no verification of this whatsoever, but it does help us demonstrate that the evolutionist has a presupposition, a religious one, and most of the evolutionists are content in continuing to believe in those religious presuppositions despite any logical objection. So, has nothing changed over tens of thousands or even millions of years when we're going to get into, because we're going to get into potassium-argon dating in just a moment. So if we cannot determine a consistent measure, like consistent measuring standard, and we cannot verify that standard measurement in all life on Earth, so we have to have a constant. What is the exact amount, and can we make that amount fit all life on Earth throughout all time? And the all time is kind of the point here. See, we have what's called a uniformitarian assumption. Uniformitarian meaning that the way things are happening today is the way they've always been happening, and nothing has ever changed. It's just like a status quo. But it's an assumption that if there was a standard of measurement, and if we could verify all life for that standard, and that all life took in the same amount of that standard, the evolutionist is still assuming C14 amounts and the half-life rate of C14 have remained the same for thousands and millions of years. It is not possible that anyone could know that unless you travel back in time and get accurate measurements for the things we cannot measure. So let me take this for example. The evolutionists really hate this example, and that's why I'm going to give it. got to stir them up a little bit. So to demonstrate this concept more simplistically, let's scientifically analyze a candle and ask a few questions. Let's imagine we walk into a room and a candle is burning on a table. Now we measure the candle and find that the candle is 6 inches tall. Can we determine when the candle was lit? Not without assuming how tall the candle was before it was lit. Then we can analyze the candle for a while and determine that it is burning 1 inch per hour. Can we determine when the candle was lit? Not without assuming how tall it was and if it has always burned at the same rate. We don't know those things. Now I had an evolutionist one time, he thought he was going to be really smart, and he says, I can answer his candle example. We can just put together the melted wax and find out how tall the candle was before it was lit. Ha ha ha, I'm so smart. Okay, even if you do that, we have to recognize that number one, if you actually study the burning of candles, wax, some of the wax evaporates with the burning of the candle, which is irretrievably lost. You can't get that back. And further still, you're assuming that the wax we are analyzing is not from a different candle. You don't know that. And you're also assuming that the upper melted portion of the candle is the same as the shape, or is the same shape as the rest of the candle we currently see burning on the table. Let me give you an example real quick. I've got another image on here that I forgot to put on the stream. And I'm sorry for those of you who are listening via audio that I'm going to be doing this. But you can always go and watch this. If you want to see this on audio, you can go onto our website at creationliberty.com and you can watch this and get all the visual pictures. And here we are. This is an image of a, it's a candle made out to be, you know, like the bear honey bottles that you can buy with the honey in them, you know? It's made out to be like that. Well, you see how you're assuming that the bottom portion, how it's shaped, is exactly the same as the top portion. And it's not the case. You don't know how tall the candle was. You don't know if it's always been burning at the same rate. You don't know if any of the wax on there is from the same candle. You don't know any of that. There's only one way to verify when the candle was lit. You have to go find the person who lit it and ask, or they have to leave a note telling you how long ago it was lit. There's really no way scientifically to determine that. You see, to determine the origin of something, we must refer to eyewitness accounts. That's historical evidence, not scientific evidence, because science is limited on what it can determine. And likewise, evolutionists that rely on carbon dating must assume how much C14 there was to begin with. They must assume that C14 has always burned at the same rate. They must assume the C14 can come from no other source except the one burning on the table right in front of them. So they look at all the C14 today, they look at everything they see today, and they say, this is the way it's always been. See, and this is what kind of creates a problem here. And let me see if I can explain this properly. If you have, let's say you start with, you know, a sample of C14, and let's say, you know, the rate we are receiving C14 today is much, much greater than it was in the past. Let's say a couple thousand years ago, the amount of C14 in the atmosphere was less than what it is today. Well, what you're going to do is you're going to look at a creature that's been dead for a couple thousand years. You're going to compare it to today's rate of incoming C14. But because there was less coming into the atmosphere beforehand, this older creature is going to have less in it at the start. And when you look at the decay rate, you're actually going to think it's much older than it actually is. And that's actually what they're doing with all these different dating methods. It's actually a lot of these things they mistakenly will find that they are, if they actually were able to go back and calculate things, we'd find that probably the Earth did not have the same amount as it did before if you're going from the biblical Christian theistic worldview, okay? And that's why they make so many mistakes on that, why they get so many wild numbers. And we'll discuss that in a little bit, but I want to discuss a couple other things for you. So Now, this C14 in the atmosphere actually demonstrates, from the knowledge we do have about it, demonstrates that the Earth would have to be young. And I'll explain what I mean. But first, I need to explain to you what's called equilibrium. And let me put up another picture here. And again, if you guys are watching on audio, you want to go to our website and watch the video of this and get all the images. Or you can go onto our website and read an article about this if you really want to study the issue down, and it has a lot of those images on there. So if we turn on a garden hose and used that, like for example, you turn on a faucet on a garden hose, it's coming out at a constant rate. So we use that constant rate of water to fill up the barrel, but I drill holes in the other side of the barrel. So the hose would begin to fill up the barrel, but as the water got higher and higher, more of it would begin to leak out the other side. And it will rise at a constant level until it starts leaking out, and it will rise slower and slower until it gets to a point where it levels out. As long as you're filling up that barrel with water and it's leaking out the side, the intake is the same as the outgo. And that water level would stay in place. That consistent level of water is called equilibrium. The barrel reaches equilibrium. So likewise, if we go into C14, when the C14 is continually being created by the sun's rays striking nitrogen, that's like the water pouring in, and continually decaying from the half-life mentioned earlier, that's the water pouring out, the C14 in the atmosphere would eventually reach equilibrium. Now, Willard Livy, the inventor of carbon dating, like I talked about at the beginning, did some research on equilibrium in the atmosphere. He calculated that if you were to instantaneously, poof, create a new Earth out of nowhere and get it spinning around the sun, it would take approximately 30,000 years for the Earth's atmosphere to reach equilibrium. So, based on the assumption that the Earth is billions of years old, Willard Libby basically said, we know the Earth is billions of years old, which is his first mistake. He said, therefore, we can ignore this equilibrium problem. And that's his second mistake, because it's been recently demonstrated that the Earth's atmosphere has still not reached equilibrium. This quotation I have here from, and I'll go on to, we've had some problems with annotations recently on YouTube, but I'll go back and give those. If you want to look up the specific references for all these quotations, you can go onto my website, type in carbon dating, read the carbon dating game, all the references are given on there. It says radiocarbon is forming 28 to 37% faster than it is decaying, end quote. So this not only indicates that the Earth to be less than 30,000 years old, it also shows us the Earth is probably much less than 30,000 years old because of the large increase. This gives us more evidence of a young Earth and matches the Bible, which says God created the Earth roughly 6,000 years ago, but it is rarely ever talked about in evolutionist circles because it's devastating to the religion of evolution. The next part I want to talk to you about is how the radiometric dates are cherry-picked, because this is going to apply not just to carbon dating, it's also going to apply very heavily to the potassium-argon dating we're going to cover in just a moment. So, let me get back to my proper notes here. Okay, I want to make sure I'm in place. So, since evolutionists are using a method of dating that is inconsistent and unreliable, why does it appear that they get consistent dates? Because that's one of their arguments. Every time you mention this, they say, but why does it work then? No, it doesn't work, okay? It's called the magician's trick, and we'll show you how it's done. Now, to answer the evolutionists on this, we need to understand that radiometric dating is not actually used for dating, but for appearance. Let me say that again. It's not used for dating, it's used for appearance. It's made as something that makes what they're saying look good and to look scientific. In reality, the geologic column is what's used for dating methods, not the actual, you know, they say, oh, we determined these, we did it with scientific, you know, chemistry, and we determined that it's this old. No. It was all done based on the geologic column, because when the evolutionists get wide varieties of numbers, and out of those wide varieties of numbers, dates are cherry-picked specifically that match their preconceived geologic column. Okay, this is from New Science, Volume 100. You can go get the references are on my website, or I'll put them in the annotations if YouTube annotations are working properly again. He says, quote, apart from very modern examples, which are really archaeology, I can think of no cases of radioactive decay being used to date fossils, end quote. And there's a reason for that, guys, because they're dated based on their position in the geologic column, which is based on circular reasoning. This is from the American Journal of Science, Volume 276. Quote, radiometric dating would not have been feasible if the geologic column had not been erected first, end quote. Well, that's interesting, because that's supporting exactly the argument I'm making right now, is that without the geologic column, they can't get any definite dates on this stuff. So, basically, this applies to all the dating methods in general. So let me give you a quotation real quick about potassium-argon dating. We're not covering that yet. We'll cover that in the second half. But this is really important here and applies to carbon dating at the same time. This is from the Canadian Journal of Scientists, Volume 16, page 974. Quote, in conventional interpretation of potassium-argon age data, it is common to discard ages. Let me repeat that. It is common to discard ages which are substantially too high or too low compared with the rest of the group. The rest of what group? He says, or with the other available data such as the geologic time scale. He says the discrepancies between the rejected and the accepted are arbitrarily attributed to excess or loss of argon. Bottom line, what he just said there is that they try to say it's by, you know, potassium to argon decay, but he says they have to compare that with the available data in the geologic column. So basically, they get a wide range of numbers all over the scale. They select the numbers they want based on how old they already think it is, publish those numbers based on the standard geological column, which is how old they already think it is, and lead people to believe that radiometric dating has proven ages beyond what the Bible says. It's a sleight-of-hand magic trick the average person won't catch, and while I believe most evolutionists don't catch it themselves, there are some out there who know the public won't notice the illusion, and they get by with it. This is from proceedings from the 12th Nobel Symposium in 1970. It says, quote, if a C14 date supports our theories, we put it in the main text. If it does not entirely contradict them, we put it in a footnote. And if it's completely out of date, in quotations, we just drop it, end quote. So how did you know the dates that you threw out were wrong? And how did you know the ones that you included were right? It's all based on lining them up with the geologic column. We know how old it is by how old we think it is. That's the bottom line here. So this is from the Anthropological Journal of Canada, Volume 19, and it says, quote, no matter how useful it is, though, the radiocarbon method is still not capable of yielding accurate and reliable results. There are gross discrepancies, the chronology is uneven and relative, and the accepted dates are actually selected dates. See, that's what I was talking about there. He continues and says, this whole blessed thing is nothing but 13th century alchemy, and it all depends on which funny paper you read, end quote. Well, that's what I'm talking about. There are selected dates. They are cherry-picked specifically based on the geologic column, which is based on circular reasoning. The fossils to date rocks and the rocks to date fossils. So if you're basing your eternity, like you're questioning the accuracy of the Bible and carbon dating, I just highly suggest that you don't do that, because it's a flimsy theory full of holes, and it doesn't really have any real science to back it up. It's still based on the religious presuppositions of the evolutionists. Now, many evolutionists will come back and say, oh, but tree ring dating has proven this. We know by tree ring dating, you know, or what's called dendrochronology is what they call this. We know that the earth, you know, or that the earth is older than 6,000 years, so we can go back and count it on the trees, okay? So they say they can go back and count the tree rings, because the tree rings are typically called annual rings. And dendrochronology is defined, the definition is, the science dealing with the study of the annual rings of trees and determining the dates and chronological order of past events. So let me go back and I'll give you a general overview. Here's how tree ring dating works. A core drill is used to get a small portion of a tree, of a width of a tree. They take this tiny drill and they go in and they get this tiny little, it's like a long stick that comes out of the middle of the tree. Then the rings of the tree are counted. Each ring, according to the evolutionists, is supposed to count as a year. So if they count 100 rings, then the tree is supposed to be 100 years old. That's basically how it works. This, however, assumes that the rings are annual. and that has never been proven. In fact, many trees throughout the world have been demonstrated to produce more than one ring per year. No one knows for sure why they produce more than one ring per year, but experiments seem to indicate that changes in humidity level might cause the ring patterns. Again, it is still not determined for sure why the rings, what causes the rings for sure. Now, trees can produce more than one ring. Trees can produce more than one ring per year, and sometimes they do only produce one ring per year, and sometimes they produce one ring in multiple years. That also happens. You see, in some cases, one ring can be equal to 1 year, but not in all cases. And that's something that the evolutionists will basically flat right out ignore, because they want very badly to believe in the religion they've chosen. So whatever, even if we can just deceive the public to make them believe in this, that's fine, as long as they can believe in evolution and still call it science. It's a religion, folks. Now, this is a picture of Methuselah. This isn't an actual picture of Methuselah. I'm sorry. This is a picture of a bristlecone pine. I'm going to talk about Methuselah. I don't know if there are any pictures out there of Methuselah, because that's something that's been kept quiet. It's supposed to be the oldest living tree on the planet that's been recorded. They don't divulge the location of it because they're afraid people are going to go out there and try to, you know, take off pieces of the oldest living tree, and they're going to end up destroying it. So they don't want anybody to know where it's at. Now, we have to take their word for it, but, you know, I believe them, that they probably, you know, found a tree that has 4,789 rings to it, okay? And there's a reason I'm showing you a picture of these bristlecone pines, which is what a Methuselah tree is. They claim they found it, all right, in 1957. But first of all, I want to ask you a question. Look at this tree. Bristlecone pines grow like this. They're a gnarled mess. How do you begin to get an accurate core to this tree to find out how old it is? Where do you start and where do you finish? I mean, it's not like this perfectly round, nice tree like we get, you know, like from evergreens or oaks or things like that. So I don't know that I guess I would have to question them on the 4,789 rings, because it depends on how you're measuring it, number one. And, of course, this was discovered back in 1957. This is what they claim. You can see NOVA's program. They talk about the Methuselah tree on PBS back in 2001. They reported on this. So, anyway, I doubt that anyone could prove a particular core sample from that tree was accurate. But the trees have been known to produce multiple rings per year. And even if, let's say you watch the bristlecone pines today, and let's say you could say, well, they're producing one ring a year in that climate right now. Do you know that's been the climate for the past few thousand years? You know the climate's been exactly the same and has never changed? They don't know that, and that's the problem. See, it's as far as they know. See, but then they make huge leaps to assert that this is a fact of science, that they're getting these accurate dates from these trees. So to make the claim that the bristlecone pines have never produced more than one ring per year is to claim absolute knowledge of the tree over the past few thousand years, as if you have been there the whole time and have seen it yourself. There would be no way to prove the climate of the area in which they grow has always remained the same. There would be no way to prove the tree itself has not produced more than one ring per year at any point in the past 4,000 years. They assume the tree rings are annual at all points. Now, Dr. Walter E. Lammers, a PhD in genetics, ran experiments in Freedom, California, that demonstrated bristlecone pines can produce extra rings in a year based on the humid dry climate changes. It would be a very large leap of faith to assume that only one ring per year for thousands of years of undocumented climate in the White Mountains. Okay, so we've already got scientists who said, look, this is not the case, that there are annual rings. We don't know. But they're assumed by the evolutionists, so they would have something to say that the Earth is older than the Bible says it is, which is what they really want in the end. And again, it's all circular reason. They say, well, we need carbon dating in order to prove how old the trees are, right? They use carbon dating to carbon date trees to say how old they are. Then they say, okay, we're going to count the rings. And that's going to prove the carbon dating is true. No, they're both built on the same assumptions, okay? Huge systematic assumptions. So it's one assumption proves the other assumption, and the other assumption proves this assumption. Again, it becomes circular reasoning on things they do not know. So the tree ring dating dendrochronology does not work, folks. Now the other thing they'll say that well, we can verify carbon dating because of ice core dating. The U.S. there's actually a national ice core laboratory. I kind of object as to why we're wasting our tax dollars, knowing that here, let me switch the picture for you. Why we're wasting our tax dollars, knowing that the state of the country that we're in, but yet we have plenty of money to keep up a gigantic freezer with ice cores in it. Yeah, that's certainly helping us right now. But the U.S. National Ice Core Laboratory, which you can go look up, I forget exactly what the I was trying to find what the was it NICL dot USGS dot gov, I think is the website for that if you want to go look it up. But they drill down through thick layers of ice in places like Greenland and the South Pole. They retrieve core samples at these locations and bring them back. This is a quote from the Ice Core Laboratory government website. They said, quote, "An ice core from the right site can contain an uninterrupted, detailed climate record extending back hundreds of thousands of years," end quote. So the ice cores contain many rings, just like, you know, tree rings. So they take a drill down there, they drill way down through ice, and they bring up this long pole of ice, okay? And it has a bunch of layers to it. In the summertime, some ice, this is the way the theory goes. I'm gonna explain to you what they believe, and then we're gonna discuss it. In the summertime, some ice is melted, it becomes soft and it compacts, then it refreezes in the winter and forms a distinct layer. The evolutionists make one big mistake in this, however. They assume the ice cores are annual rings. Now these layers and rings are called the layers and rings are called glacial fern. Fern is partially compacted snow and ice that's been recrystallized. However, it doesn't take an entire year for this to happen, and that's the problem with what they're assuming. Here's a picture example of what this looks like, this glacial fern, and you can see where the different it's it you can clearly see the different layers where it's indicated some of it got compact and then refroze, and that's what's causing those different layers to form on that. But there are many places on the Earth where many layers of this can be laid down in a matter of weeks, depending on the climate change. These are not necessarily annual rings at all. And I'll show you an example of that. Now, the evolutionists really hate it when I bring up this example, which is probably another reason why I'm going to show it to you, because it really irritates them, because it's so incredibly foolproof on this that there's not really any mistake you can make on this one. In World War II in 1942, a group of P-38 airplanes, and the Germans called them the Fork-tailed Devil back then, because they were so, I mean, they were so effective in the war against the German armies. They were heading from America to England, and this group of P-38s got caught in a storm. They were forced to emergency land in Greenland. The first plane came in with the wheels down and flipped the plane over due to rough ice, because, I mean, it's an emergency landing, you got to do what you can. The other planes were advised to belly land without their wheels. After 2 weeks, the soldiers were rescued and the planes were left behind because it would have been too costly to retrieve them from those harsh conditions. And today, these planes are commonly known as the Lost Squadron. That's something you want to keep in mind today, or in mind for as I talk about this, called the Lost Squadron. Now, in 1990, 50 years later, a man from Kentucky wanted to go get those airplanes and restore them. And he suspected they would be sitting on top of the ice, waiting for someone to come pick them up. But the retrieval turned out to be a bit more complicated than that. Now, let me switch an image here so we can see this. Now, what happened was, using the ground-penetrating radar they had, the planes were located 3 miles from where they originally landed because of the movement of the ice glacier. In less than 50 years, they were trapped under 263 feet of ice. That's a lot. This is from Creation Ex Nihilo in 1997 when they were talking about this. Quote, "In Greenland and Antarctic, where the weather is constantly dry and very cold, the glaciers are miles thick, but the annual rings are very thin. The deepest cores can measure over 10,000 feet, cores from Greenland drilled since 1990 show northern climate was erratic 135,000 years ago. That was when they were quoting some of the scientific investigation when they went down there. Well, the 135 years ago is assuming their annual rings. So the Lost Squadron accumulated 263 feet of ice over 48 years, and this is a picture of the guy who went down there, and they drilled down through to try to retrieve these planes. So 263 feet of ice in 48 years. If you calculate that out, it comes to an average of 5.5 feet per year. If you have 10,000 foot, if you have a 10,000 foot ice core sample, divide that at that same rate, you only have about 1,800 years, not 135,000. See, because that 135,000 came from the exact same rough location on that glacier as these planes did. So what they're calculating out here doesn't even make any sense, first of all. But Bob Carden is one of the men that helped dig out the P-38 fighter planes. In an interview, he reported that at 62 feet down, they pulled up pieces of plywood where another team in 1983, that was 7 years earlier, tried to dig out the planes. That comes out to about 8 feet per year. He also reported that they dug through many hundreds of layers of ice as they went through 260 feet to get the planes. Well, that's interesting. If those were annual layers, there should have been 48 layers in 48 years. But there were many hundreds of layers because those layers are not annual layers. The National Ice Core Laboratory has been informed of this data, proving that their ice core dating is incorrect, but they still insist that the layers are annual because they get a tax-funded, it's a tax-funded institution, guys. They have a paycheck. And if their research is useless, they don't get paid anymore. So why would you ever report the truth? Again, the love of money being the root of all evil. All right, now we're going to switch gears and we're going to go to potassium-argon dating and talk about that. Now, once again, I'm going to describe the half-life on this, okay? And this is an image I created to help understand that. Just like you said, whereas the carbon dating half-life is supposed to be 5,700 years, roughly, the potassium-argon dating is supposed to be 1.3 billion years half-life, roughly. So you're going to lose half of your sample after 1.3 billion years, then 2.6 billion years, you lose half of that, the remaining, then 3.9 billion years, you lose half of that remaining, 5.2 billion years, you lose half of that remaining, and so on, until it gets to a point where you can't measure it anymore. So to explain this in more, that basically explains it. I'm not going to go on and explain that. You can check out the stuff on the website, and if you're having a confusing time understanding that, check out the images on the website. That'll help you to understand what it's describing. This is from the University of California, Santa Barbara, called potassium. It's Chronological Method 9 Potassium Argon Dating from the ucsb.edu website. They said, quote, geologists have used this method to date rocks as much as 4 billion years old. It is based on the fact that some of the radioactive isotope of potassium, potassium-40, decays to argon, to the gas argon as argon-40. By comparing the proportion of K-40 to argon-40 in a sample of volcanic rock and knowing the decay rate of K-40, the date that the rock formed can be determined, end quote. So this is how they say it's done, okay? Now, keep in mind the decay rates can be argued, all right? Bring decay rates into a court of law and put it under real scrutiny, and a good case could be made against them. But I don't think it's necessary to show the major problems evolutionists already have with what they're claiming. You know, it's, you know, you don't have to have to argue the decay rates. So in this instance, I'm just not going to be arguing what they claim for the current K rate is. But just to, you know, kind of, you know, chase this rabbit as we go by real quick. The typical they'll have a sample that they will watch potassium decay into argon gas, okay? And what they do is they'll have a time for testing in which they're going to try to analyze the rate of decay. Typically, it only lasts for about 3 days. For all of the dating methods I'm aware of, they usually only take about 3 days. They analyze the rate of decay, and after 3 days, they say, here's how long this will take to break down. So basically, they watched potassium break down to argon gas for 3 days and say it's going to take 1.3 billion years for this to happen. I think a pretty good case in a court of law could be made against that. That's what I'm trying to explain. But that's not what we're going to discuss right now. Now, we have a few problems here. Problem number one that we're going to talk about is contamination. Okay. Here, let me quote this for you. This is from the Planetary Sciences Abstracts for the 8th Annual Meeting, page 167. You can also see a paper called Transactions, American Geophysical Union, Volume 48, talks about this. It says, quote, "As much as 80% of the potassium in a small sample of iron meteorite can be removed by distilled water in 4.5 hours, end quote. Well, that's pretty funny, because if 80% of your sample can be washed away by water in a few hours, what basis do evolutionists claim that their potassium samples have not been contaminated? It's assumed. It is a complete assumption that the samples that they're looking at have not been contaminated for billions of years. Now, this is something that a sober evolutionist would probably never admit. Usually you're going to have to give them on their third or fourth beer before they say, yeah, there's some serious problems with this. But the evolutionists are still stretching the imagination to its limits to assume that the samples they are testing have not been contaminated for millions, if not billions, of years. Therefore, it is not knowledge, it is religious belief that they're making these assumptions on. The second problem is the inconsistent rates of decay. The evolutionists today see the half-life decay rate of potassium to argon at 1.3 billion years, but how do they know that the decay rate has been the same for millions and millions of years? What if 5,000 years ago the decay rate was different? How would they know? There's no way they could possibly know that. To put it bluntly, the evolutionists have no clue but assume decay rates to be constant, because if they don't, radiometric dating is impossible, which is why I say it's not science, it's religion. Third problem, known ages don't work. Now you can get this from, this is Keith Swenson, he's an author on went on an expedition to gather igneous rock with Dr. Stephen Austin. He said, quote, "In June of 1992, Dr. Austin collected a 15-pound block of dacite, I guess, or dacite, I can't remember how you pronounce that, from high on a lava dome, on the lava dome, excuse me. A portion of this sample was crushed and processed into a whole rock powder, as well as four mineral concentrates. These were submitted for potassium-argon analysis to Geochron Laboratories of Cambridge. The only information provided to the laboratory were the samples should show low argon, or low argon should be expected. The laboratory was not told that the specimen came from the lava dome at Mount St. Helens and was only 10 years old. So basically, they took the rock samples directly from Mount St. Helens, processed them, sent them to the lab, and did not tell them where they came from. Now, volcanic rock, according to the evolutionists, is the best way to date with potassium-argon dating, because theoretically, when a volcano erupts, all the argon gas from the rock is released. And then when everything cools down, it resets the clock back to zero, where you only just have potassium in the samples. Now, that sounds all good in theory, but in practice, like with the rocks at Mount St. Helens, which erupted in 1980, strange numbers come back from the rocks. Now, the following are the lab results. I have a chart listed out here you can see on our website, but I'm going to give you the range that they got from these Mount St. Helens samples, which Mount St. Helens erupted, remember, only 30 years ago. So we should only have 30 years of radiometric decay to analyze. But they got ages ranging from 0.35 million years up to 2.8 million years with potassium-argon dating. So why are dated samples like this not published in journals like Science and Nature to demonstrate that potassium-argon has serious problems? Well, let me give you this example. Again, well, actually, you know what? We only read this earlier. I forgot we already covered this one. But basically, let me repeat the quotation I gave you earlier. Quote, "In conventional interpretation of potassium-argon age data, it is common to discard ages which are substantially too high or too low compared with the rest of the group or with other available data such as the geologic timescale," end quote. If they would have told them before they gave them the samples these came from Mount St. Helens, they would have said, sorry, we can't potassium-argon date these. They're just, it's too young. We need to waste some time before we can do that. But they didn't tell them that, and those are the age ratings they got from it. It demonstrates that the known ages do not work. If you know how old the thing is supposed to be, it doesn't work. And I'll show you this chart to explain to you exactly how this is done. Remember I talked about the cherry-picking method that is used by the evolutionists. Again, in the Lies of Evolution Geologic Column, that's the title of an article we have on our website, we covered how the geologic column is made up from pure imagination. And I'll go ahead and give a link to that on the description in on the YouTube video if you want to see that, or if you're listening by audio, just go to creationliberty.com, type in geologic column, and that article, Lies of Evolution Geologic Column, should pop up, and you can read more about that. So basically, we covered how the geologic column is made up from pure imagination. So they throw out an age if it doesn't line up with their geologic column. So more simply put, they throw out an age if it doesn't line up with how old they already think it is. You see how this works? Basically, let's say, like you're seeing in the image on the screen right now, let's say they get, you know, a large range of dates, which is what they usually do. Let's say they get one for 20 million, they get 80 million years, 150 million years, and 300 million years from this rock sample. Well, how do they know which one to select? Well, they will particularly select the one that matches with how old the geologic column says it is. That is exactly how it's done, folks. I mean, I know a lot of you guys may be shocked to see this and say, really? Like, I thought they did all this really scientific stuff. Oh, there is some incredible science that goes into it. You should go onto YouTube and check out a video sometime on how they actually do, you know, carbon date samples. There's a lot of science that goes into it, but the actual dating and the results they come up with are completely cherry-picked based on religion, not science. And that's the difference we have to understand. Now, the fourth problem we have with this is that unknown ages are assumed to work. We know the ages of, or excuse me, dates of known age, when they radiometric date them, we know they don't work. But when we have unknown ages to something, it's assumed to work. That doesn't logically follow at all. In 1970, for example, Nature, okay, this was on April 18th, 1970, page 226, along with many other major journals, science journals, Nature was now the only one that published this because it was a big issue back then, they published dates of the volcanic rock from what's called the KBS Tuff. Now, tuff is volcanic rock and ash, and the KBS Tuff is called KBS because it was named after Brinsmeyer, I think is how you pronounce her name. And I guess she gets to have it named after her because she found the rock ash. I guess if you're digging in the, you know, dirt out in Africa and you don't find it, all you find is rock ash, you gotta have it named after something. You gotta get famous for something. That's the point, right? So basically, all this took place in Kenya. Okay. Now, this KBS Tuff had been dated many times with potassium argon dating back in 1970. And almost every evolutionary scientist and source in the world, all the journals and everything, agreed that the KBS Tuff was 212 to 230 million years old based on potassium-argon dating. Okay? Now, it was important publication because this dated volcanic rock was going to be used as what's called an event horizon. You remember when I said a volcano erupts and it resets the clock back to zero, it releases the argon gas, everything melts back, and then you just have the potassium that resets the clock? They said this event horizon, a volcano erupted there, reset the clock, and that basically everything they find in all the layers above, below, where they found this tuff or inside of it is going to label how old this thing is. So everything's going to be compared back to this KBS tuff. Now the problem was, 2 years later, an evolutionist by the name of Richard Leakey was digging in the KBS tuff, and he found a human skull, which the skull number is KNMER1470, in case you want to go look that up and research it. The average person reading this might not think anything significant about this, okay? Like, they're reading this article online, which is what I'm referencing to, okay? Like, they say, okay, they found a human skull in there, so what? Well, remember, the geologic column says that mankind only first began to appear 3 million years ago. And of course, modern man, which is the type of skull he found, would have only been around at minimum 500,000 years ago, according to their models. Well, you're now finding a modern man somewhere dated between 500,000, that's 0.5 million, up to 3 million years old, that was found in rock layers that were supposed to be dated at 230 million years old. Whoops, we have a problem. Now, before we continue, the average layman that's listening to this would say, well, okay, why don't they just go back and say, we found this human skull in there, so that means humans were around 230 million years ago. Isn't that what they should do? Well, yeah, because remember, they potassium argon dated it. They knew it was between 212 to 230 million years old. But you know what? That's not what they did. They redated the KBS Tuff. Now, before we continue on anything, we know two things for certain. Number one, evolutionists, even ones that are listening to this, most of the ones that listen to this podcast, and most evolutionary scientists, they know for a fact radiometric dating does not work like they say it does. It's all based on the geologic column. And that brings me to my second point. Evolutionists are dating objects based on the imaginary geologic column, not by any scientific method, guys. It's all based on what they religiously believe, how old they already think it is. So what did they do? They found this skull. It upset completely their entire geologic column, so the evolutionists took 10 more samples, sent that around, despite the fact that they had already dated this many times and it was already determined to be that old. But this is a quotation. I can give you the, like, for example, this is from, I see here, this is information based off of Nature Volume 247 in February 1974. Quoted from Bones of Contention. You can find information about that from that book as well, which you can get the, again, I'll provide the references later. Quote, late in 1974, Fitch, Miller, and associates published the results of their revised study, a broad scatter of apparent ages from 10 different samplings ranging from 0.52 to 2.464 million years. End quote. What did I just say? Do you remember what, just a moment ago, I said that the date, that the age of the skull, according to the geologic column, has to put it between like 0.5 and 3 million years. So where did they just put it? 0.5 to 2.5 million years old. They did exactly. I mean, I could have done that, guys. If you, oh, find it there. Oh, let me go look at the geologic column. Here's what we should date it. So pull out all those selected cherry pick dates, based on this. Guys, it's just basic logic to understand that the evolutionists are doing this based on a religion, not part of science. Okay. So now, first of all, you have to understand, 230 million down to 0.5 million. I heard somebody say once that's something like a 9,000% margin of error. That's how far they were off. But these are scientists, don't question them. Everybody said this is how old it is. And now they're giving 0.5 to 2.5, which is a 500% error margin. It's over a 500% error margin. But we're expected to believe that this is part of science. It's not part of science, guys. It's part of their evolutionary religion. And the geologic column is their Bible. That's what they're basing this on. So basically, and I guess we'll put this image. A lot of people laughed when they saw this one. Again, go onto the website. If you're listening by audio, you can go on the website and take a look at that about radiometric dating. But these same problems appear in all of the dating methods across the board. Like, we could cover a bunch more, but it doesn't matter. Because some atheists will say, well, what about this one? And what about this one? And what about, it doesn't matter how many questions you answer, it will not convert them, guys. They're not going to convert to a Christian theistic position because their brains told them that was right. Because everybody has a bias, they have a presupposition. They have to be converted by God's law, people. You give them the law, and that's what converts them to believing on Jesus Christ. I mean, they're not going to believe on Jesus Christ because you tell them radiometric dating is wrong, but I want Christians to be able to have an answer for this so you don't get confused and you don't get dragged into their pagan religion. I want you to be able to stand on the biblical foundations, okay? So, why is this radiometric dating stuff still being used if they can't do it? You see, when talking about radiometric dating, it can best be compared to a magician using his cape to conceal his illusion. The average person can see a serious problem with the re circular reasoning and the non-existence of the geolo that the geologic column's built on. So, to hide the obvious, evolutionists throw a cloak over their evidence called radiometric dating. And they say, oh, it's scientific, and they throw all these numbers at you. And it confuses a lot of people. They say, oh, well, They're PhDs, so I guess we gotta listen to them. Guys, PhDs are not the foundation for truth and knowledge. The Bible's the foundation for truth and knowledge for the Christian. So they claim they use the scientific method to get billions of years, but it's nothing more than a sleight of hand falsely called science. That's all it is. And 1 Timothy says, O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoid profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science, falsely so called, which some professing have erred concerning the faith. That's exactly what happens, guys. In these verses, the Bible tells us that people would err from the faith by falsely claiming things to be scientific knowledge. And that's exactly the case we have with radiometric dating. And it's a shame that many of those who are believers on Jesus Christ, who hold the Christian theistic position, who still will believe that this radiometric dating stuff has some sort of merit to it. It has nothing. It's complete religion, because all of the assumptions are based on the evolutionary religion. And you're going to see a lot of people attack me in the comments. Evolutionists will do exactly that. But they're not going to answer to my major points here. They're not going to answer to the assumptions and say, that's not an assumption because we know it based on this. Because I've covered the basis of what they're trying to claim. And they can't claim that's part. I mean, they can go out and tell you it's science. But folks, we're not supposed to just believe that it's science just because somebody calls it that. And that's why it says it's oppositions of science, falsely so-called. So we're going to wrap this up. Thanks for listening for as long as you did. And guys, I don't believe, again, this what I just presented in this podcast here is not going to convert anyone away from the religious faith in evolution. But I do expect that this would help Christians to stay sound in their faith towards our Lord Jesus Christ, who cannot lie to us, and he is the source of all knowledge and truth. Now, the so-called science journals, because, you know, that kind of junk is not real science. There are things scientific posted in the science journals, okay? I'm not saying they're all, everything is unscientific. But concerning this evolution junk, it certainly is. And concerning radiometric dating, it certainly is. The science journals are not the source of authority and knowledge. And I urge Christians to remember your foundation and not lean to believe everything you hear just because it was said by a scribe, a.k.a. a PhD, okay? So that's it. Hey, listen, I pray that God would bless you guys very prosperously, you and your families, and I pray that he would continue to bless you as you continue to study his word, both you and me. I hope he blesses all of us with that. So anyway, thanks for joining us this time, guys, and we'll see you next time. Thanks a lot.